Shrink Wrap Radio number 529, On the Divine Human with Dr. John C. Robinson.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Dr. John C. Robinson, who has been my guest three times previously, discussing his books on aging. Today, we'll be speaking about his 2016 book on the Divine Human, The Final Transformation of Sacred Aging. For more information about Dr. John C. Robinson, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Once again, today's episode is sponsored by SwellBee.com, a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers to manage and market their practice. Free and easy to use, sign up today at SwellBee.com. Now, here's the interview. Dr. John C. Robinson, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio. I think you've been on the show not once, not twice, but three times before, which, you know, might be a bit of a record.
It's a great pleasure to be here. I always enjoy talking to you, and that's a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, great. I'm glad you feel that way. This is the first time we've done it using video, however. Mm-hmm. And the first time we spoke, it was about your book, What Aging Men Want. And then we did The Three Secrets of Aging, and then Fairy Tales and the New Aging. So what a ride it's been.
Yeah. No, this material just kept pouring out of me, and I'm so grateful that you were willing to let me share it with you.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure. And now you've just brought out a new book called The Divine Human, The Final Transformation of Aging. Oh, the final,
final
curtain coming down. So you've written a number of books about aging. What has propelled you to write yet another one?
Well, I've had this singular vision of the divine world and the mystical nature of experience ever since I was young. But I really went into psychology because there was no room at that time for a mystical approach to living. Things are much more organized around formal religious concepts and beliefs. So I've been following this revelation for all my life. And then in this last, say, 10 years, it just came evolving out of me. I had to write it. You know, some people wonder, what are you going to do when you retire? Well, I didn't have any choice. I just had to write. And so I do this to give form. And this is really probably my last book, to give form to an understanding of the world that I think is enormously important and considerably ignored everywhere. I mean, I think if we understood who we really were and where we really were, life would change. And that's one of the things that happens in aging. We get a kind of an opportunity for wisdom and reflection and silence that takes us into a new dimension of life and consciousness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I seem to recall in the book, you talk about at a very young age, actually having a sense of, I don't know whether you would call it the divine, but you had a sense that you were aware of a dimension that maybe your age mates weren't, mm-hmm. and wondered maybe if you were odd or something. At about what age did that begin for you?
You know, I think that young children all have this mystical dimension of their lives before the left hemisphere comes in and kind of hijacks consciousness with ideas.
Yeah,
we have this magic. We live in a magic, enchanting, entrancing world of immediate divine experience. And then when we go to school and have all these other experiences, we progressively, you know, give it up for the collective beliefs that we grow into. So, yeah, and I did feel different because I wanted to talk about this stuff. And, mm-hmm. and you know, I would talk about it in whatever ways I did at 10 or 12. And I got glassy-eyed, looked back at my parents. My father was a scientist. My mother was very interested in psychoanalysis. So for them, religion was either superstition or neurosis.
Yeah.
Even talking about it.
Yeah, really interesting. You know, you're reminding me of an interview that I did some years back, but that really left an imprint on me. And I'm I'm going to block on the author's name right now because I block on a lot of names at this point in the aging process. But he's a psychologist from the University of West Georgia. And he wrote a book on spirituality in children.
Oh, yes. Morse?
I'm not sure. What's the whole name?
I can't remember.
Yeah.
Whatever. So,
I hope he's not listening. It was a wonderful book.
Yeah.
And that really, he had a lot of anecdotes to share from children, about children. It had been an area of study for some time. And it was fairly startling, some of the things that children will say. And even with my own kids, there were a few instances where, you know, I had to do a double take and go, whoa, yeah, where is this being from? Speaking
that's
this
the idea, the deep, old soul.
Yeah, this deep spiritual truth. And so I know what you're talking about there. And as I recall, you later went on, you've got 2 degrees. You got a psychologist degree, but also a div of ministry. I don't know how you say that.
After I retired, I went back to school with Matthew Fox.
Yeah.
And got a doctorate of ministry. And then, because I was totally interested in understanding the mystics further, I've been reading mystics all my life, and he really is a proponent that we are all mystics. We just don't seem to realize it, but if we did, things would change. So I studied with him and got this doctorate of ministry, and then I went on to an interfaith seminary and again studied the mystics from around the world, because these are folks who just have this firsthand experience, this revelation of the way the world really is. And as a psychologist, and I guess as a person, I've always been far more interested in direct data and firsthand experience than in all the theory and theology and scripture in the world. I wanted to know for myself what was real.
Well, it seems like that dimension, that experiential dimension, has opened up for you.
Yes.
I gather from
absolutely.
The book. Yeah. And was there a pivotal moment when that process when the oyster first started to open up?
Well, you know, there are probably many, but when you ask that question, the first one that comes to mind was I was on a religious retreat in the Los Gatos Mountains, and I was walking along this high, dusty trail and you know, saying to myself, God, where are you? What is this whole business about God and how you experience firsthand? And suddenly, I became aware that there was a consciousness around me that was aware of me being aware of it.
Wow.
And it was so astounding. And suddenly I understood that consciousness is not really just in me. I am in it. And that, as the mystics say, all consciousness is a single consciousness, the universal consciousness that lives us all. So the realization I got was that my consciousness is not just my consciousness. If when we remove all the identity, time, and story fixtures that the left hemisphere wants us to nail it with and simply stay in it, we realize it's a direct experience of God's consciousness. That, if you take it seriously and if you stay in that consciousness, begins to change your understanding of yourself and your perception of the world.
There was an image in the book, and I don't remember if it was a dream or some other kind of consciousness experience that harkens back to open heart surgery that you had. And I think we may have discussed that in a previous interview. But it crops up in this book where you have this image of being opened up. I'll let you tell it. And there were sort of layers. Does that ring a bell?
Yeah. So when I was 14 years old, I underwent open heart surgery to correct an atrial septal defect, you know, hole in the heart that was going to and probably take my life by the mid 40s because it was such a severe heart murmur. During that operation, I actually woke up. And I woke up to experience hands working inside my heart. But, of course, you're frozen with curare-like neuromuscular blockers. So you can't move, you can't communicate, you can't say anything.
Wow.
And your eyes are taped shut and your body temperature is low. And it's a horrifying experience for a child. I split the whole thing off, had to. I never could have grown up if I'd had that trauma, you know, devastating my psyche. So 40 years to the month later, you know, I'm an older guy. I go into atrial fibrillation because I'm working too hard, seeing too many clients every day, and go to the emergency room to get defibrillated. And the defibrillating shock triggered body memories of the whole thing. And for the next 2 to 3 years, I was reliving this horrible surgery. And what I got in retrospect, looking back on it, was that I really had an adolescent initiation, you know, almost shamanic, like an initiation where I was dead and reborn, literally, like a living autopsy. But it was too horrifying for me to process until I was much, much older and could take this journey down into my own history and come back out again and understand how what it taught me about life and about consciousness.
Yes, yes. Wow, I didn't realize that you were that young when that happened. I know we spoke about it before, but I did not remember that it was so young. And still, there was something that you touched on in the book that you aren't quite saying, where you had, I don't know if it was a dream, but you got this imagery of levels, going down levels. Your chest was open, your heart was there, and then you went beneath that.
Got it. Okay. There was a wonderful exercise in one of the courses at the University of Creation Spirituality. And Matthew Fox always had this process called art is meditation, where you not only learn stuff with your left hemisphere, but you experienced it in a very, very experiential way. So I was drawing this picture of my heart surgery. And so the top layer was my chest, and then I cut it open, and then there was my heart. And then I put another layer of paper under that, and then I opened that up. And then when I opened my heart up, I was surprised to find that I had drawn a picture of the Buddha. It was surrounded by light.
That was it,
Yeah, and it's like, oh my gosh, this is what Ramana Maharshi, this is what the mystics talk about. At the center of your soul, there is a divine consciousness that is exposed. And for me, it just happened to be exposed literally. I mean, I was literally taken apart. Muhammad, actually, there's a great story about Muhammad who was, you know, sort of abducted by angels. And he, too, had his body opened, his heart taken out and washed clean and put back in his body. So I think it's both an archetypal metaphor as well as, you know, a literal one. Who we are, the mystics tell us that we are literally made of the divine. And we don't see that because we're off in our left hemisphere thinking about everything. But when we stop thinking and really intensely become aware of our own being, the being of our being, we discover that is like the Hindus say, they call it Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, bliss. It's filled with this utter joy of existence and a kind of a loving wisdom that is part of the whole cosmos. That's what I think we can begin to understand in the new aging experience.
Yeah, so the title of your book is The Divine Human, and so I guess what you've just said is the grounding for that notion?
Yeah, the divine human is someone who has learned to experience their own divinity, that has learned to experience consciousness and being, not just as their own, but as the consciousness and being of God. And by the way, you can use any other word you want for God, because it's kind of a word that has a lot of baggage. So people should use whatever word makes them feel connected to the sacred. But in any case, so the wisdom that we get from this new consciousness is that the world is not what we think it is, nor are we.
Yeah, you write about
another existence.
You write about dissolving the false self, which I guess is what you're getting at when you say, nor are we. Isn't that what psychotherapy is for? Or are you dissolving the false self, or are you getting at something else?
No, I think it is. After years of psychotherapy, doing psychotherapy, I really deeply appreciate that much of the psychotherapeutic journey is about giving up the self that we took on because we were supposed to, because the culture validated it, because our parents said it was the right thing, and instead get in touch with the true self, who we were literally born to be, which is something that's really hardwired in us. But as the mystics say, they say, you know, who you are is God's gift to you, and what you do with it is your gift to God. So there's something about the true self, once we begin to find it, that is it itself an opening into this new dimension of life and consciousness.
Yeah. Now, Let's talk about states of consciousness a bit. It sounds like you've experienced some fairly profound altered states yourself. Talk about the state that creates this divine human, or brings in the awareness, I guess, of one's divinity.
Yeah, the state of consciousness I'm talking about really is a consciousness free from the thought forms of identity, time, and story, free of the whole problem-ridden labyrinth of mind that is generated from the left hemisphere. I'm recently rereading Sperry and Gazzaniga's work, you know, about the split brain.
Yes.
And it's really clear to me that, you know, that we have, as they say, two different, you know, autonomous entities living inside of us. We just are dominated by the left brain, which is curiously called the dominant hemisphere. But when we begin to quiet the mind and bring consciousness into itself, we discover that nothing is what we think it is, because, you know, it's all thought. And this new state of consciousness is not that hard to do. It's not like you have to sit in meditation for 20 hours a day. It takes a different approach to experiencing it, but once you do, then the world begins to change.
Well, what's your advice for cracking that egg? Because many people have had to sit for for years, you know, in pursuit of that kind of an experience. And maybe you have a genetic propensity. I don't know.
Well, I suspect I do. I was sort of born a mystic, but that's not enough. I think the royal road to mystical consciousness is the intensive sensory focus. In other words, if you are walking a balance beam or threading a needle or painting trim or climbing a difficult, you know, rock wall, you know, you're so intensely in your senses, you're not thinking about your resume, you're not thinking about your taxes. You can't do both things.
Right.
So the real key here is, can you shift from this logical, thought-driven mind into a sensory awareness that locks you into this other state of consciousness? Hmm. It's like, you know, you're sitting at night, you know, reading a book, and you hear something scratching outside your window. You know, you don't keep reading. You don't think about what it could be. You suddenly get awake, really awake, and you listen. That's the state I'm talking about. And you can take it further and call it radical awe, because in this state of awe, you know, the world becomes brighter and more beautiful, and you begin to have more transcendent experience.
Mm-hmm. So what else can you say about, you know, how one gets there or prepares for it? Because it sounds like it's something that you have kind of cultivated in your life.
Well, I think there's a practice, and I've talked about this practice in many of my books. Ordinary Enlightenment talks about it in depth, so does Finding Heaven Here. It has to do with like four steps. You have to stop thinking, which means shifting to the sensory mode.
Not easy to do, though, to stop thinking.
It's by shifting to the sensory mode that the thinking stops. Okay, see, that's what's very interesting about this. You can't just say, I'm not going to think anymore, because you're already thinking that, and the dog is chasing its tail. But when you look at your hand intensely, and you follow, and you look at the cells, and you look at the new wrinkles and so forth, when you shift into that sensory mode, the thinking has stopped, literally. And you begin to see something that you don't normally see. So anyway, the first step is to move into the sensory mode. And the second step is to intensify it greatly, which any of us can do. It's just, you know, focus on something with as much intensity as you possibly can. That's part of the journey of awakening. And then the third step is to become conscious of consciousness itself. Okay, you know, direct consciousness back on itself with the realization that you're not just experiencing your own consciousness, which you have wrapped in a story, but that you are experiencing the consciousness of the divine. And you just stay there, conscious of consciousness. And then you bring that consciousness into your body, and you begin to feel a quality of joy and wonder and bliss and love and inclusiveness. I mean, this whole flooding up of what's in the ground of being anyway begins to define you. And as you practice these practices, and you could do them walking, you know, down the road into the woods, you can do them, you know, when you're sitting at home in the evening. I wouldn't do them driving in many other ways. Yeah. You are actually training yourself to leave the the left hemisphere, which is like a Hoover vacuum that sucks up all your consciousness and puts it into ideas. And you're leaving that for the world of what is. So when you're intensely focused on what is, you discover that it's way different than anything you think. And that is the door opening into this divine world and divine consciousness.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting that it starts with this attention to the sensory.
Yes.
Because I suspect that in the Jungian framework, I am a sensation type. There are objects that are very numinous for me. They, I'm very interested in them. They have a charge, you know.
That's exactly it. Yes, you are tapping into the divine realm that is exuding all the time.
Well, I had an experience in a Jungian workshop years ago. There was a Jungian analyst giving a workshop at a Asilomar, and he was talking about, this is somebody who is specializing in typology, and you know, most Jungians are not sensation types, I think. Mm-hmm. And there was a sense coming through this, and I actually had some interaction in the group, and I felt like I was being pegged and put down for being a sensation type, you know, instead of being more into something ethereal or mystical.
Right, yeah, an intuitive feeling type, yeah.
Yes, right. And we all have some of these elements, but I just recognize in myself that there is a strong attention to the sensate. And as I hear you talking about that state of losing awareness of everything except what you're doing, what Csikszentmihalyi calls flow, which I think might
yes.
also be related to what you're saying.
Precisely.
A couple of places that stand out for me in my own life, but one does not seem divine at all, and the other has some potential. The first is, as a boy, I was so into electronics, and I got involved in ham radio and doing things with my hands to create circuits and talking to people in distant places like we're doing now on ham radio and so on. And it just totally consumed my mind, I was right there. So that's one place. The other place, and I still have a bit of that for technology, for my iPhone, I guess is one of those numinous devices for me, as it is for quite a few people around the world. But skiing is that place where, boy, you've got to be paying attention. You've got to be right there or you're going to fall down. You know, if you like to ski fast, as I like to do, and I'm not an advanced skier by any means, but I did learn that I enjoyed the speed of it and I learned that you have to point your skis downhill to go.
Yeah.
If you're all seized up with fear, and you're trying to not turn because the turn involves pointing your skis downhill. At some point, I just learned to yield to letting my skis go downhill. And yes, I would pick up speed, but that speed would allow me then to turn or to slow down. And I think I've never felt quite so present and in my body and out of my head as when skiing.
Exactly. That's what thrill seeking is all about. You know, whether you're a whitewater rafter or a mountain climber or a skier, you get so intensely in that moment because you have to. You can't think about, you know, what you're going to talk to your wife about tomorrow because you're going to hit a rock if you don't pay attention.
Yeah.
That brings you so much to life, and that kind of intense life is the divine dimension. That's why people do it over and over again. They jump off bridges.
You know? Yeah. Well, now, you know, I'm an older guy. You're an older guy. Yeah. I'm an older guy. I'm not skiing these days. And where would I find that same kind of thing?
Oh, just take a walk in the woods. You know, just step outside into your garden and then look at things without thought. Just look at it in a consciousness free of thought, purely sensory. Look at it intensely, and you'll find it everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
And aging has this wonderful other quality, is that all, the whole, you know, constellation of identity, time, and story that we developed in our teen and then middle years, you know, this is who I am, this is what I've done, this is, you know, what I understand the world to be, begins to fall away in aging. This new aging, this unprecedented longevity that we have now that never existed before, is giving us, and particularly in the conscious aging movement where people are really working on themselves and their consciousness emotionally and spiritually, we have this false self, this false construction of reality begins to fall away, and we become more and more aware of consciousness itself. I kind of liken it to, like, if you had a jigsaw puzzle of your life, you know, you tacked it to the wall and you watched it and you started watching the pieces falling out, you know, and there's all these holes in the puzzle. Yeah. Well, that's your life coming apart. But the secret is that what's behind it, what's in the holes, is this pure consciousness that if you will spend time with it and bring it into your own physical being, the mystics have been telling us this for thousands of years, right. You become a divine being. And that's the possibility of the new aging.
So part of it is not clinging to those pieces, right? We have a natural, a kind of a natural propensity to want to hang on to those pieces because we feel like that's who I am. And so many people, when they retire and they don't have the same routine and they're not seeing all the same people all the time, there's a sense of loss.
Yes. Yeah, aging is a real crisis for most of us because we walk off a cliff, you know? I mean, I can keep calling myself a clinical psychologist, but I don't do it anymore. I haven't done it for years. And so it's now simply a fiction, an ossification of an old life that if I hang on to it, will it get in the way of this new development, this mm-hmm. new blossoming of consciousness mm-hmm. that the new aging is.
Mm-hmm. Do you still keep your license?
You know, I keep my option for my license.
I do too.
My finances go south, I might go back to work, but not intentionally.
That's exactly where I am. I mean, I haven't done therapy in a long time, but those licenses, I'm afraid to let go of them because, as you say, if the economy blows up, where are you going to run to? Interesting. So what are some of the obstacles that get in the way of us experiencing our divinity? Because I've been hanging out with some old buddies for a long time, and these are not unconscious people. These are people who've mm-hmm. meditated and attended a zillion workshops and run a zillion workshops and so on. And yet there is a struggle with aging, with not really feeling that divine. So what is it that gets in the way?
Well, I think, you know, all the talking gets in the way. I mean, this dimension of existence is most profound in the silence and stillness and present and presence that we feel in the moment. Mm-hmm. So if we are too busy talking about it, we're not going to find it. We're going to just stay in our heads. In The Three Secrets of Aging, I talk about aging as being an initiation into this new stage of consciousness, and then, which includes all the events and things that happen to us that convince us, you know, irrefutably that this is not the same world we used to live in. You know, this is not Kansas anymore. We have entered a new dimension of life. And then if we'll pay attention to it, we discover that aging is a progressive transformation of self and consciousness in this way we're talking about. And in this new consciousness, we have a revelation of a new and sacred world all around us. The reason we don't go there is all the usual suspects on the spiritual journey: doubt, you know, fear of embarrassment, fear of change. If I really did this, would I act crazy? Would I be too different? And all the triggers that pull you back into the left hemisphere. You know, someone mm-hmm. says, you know, I don't like your clothes, or cuts you off on the road, or says that. That's a, you know, we try to describe this process, but it's in many ways it's ineffable. And so you try to describe it, and someone says that doesn't make sense, and you talk about it some more, and you, before you know it, you're wrapped up again in the left hemisphere. We need to keep reminding ourselves, stop thinking, heighten awareness, come into the moment, you know, intensify awareness, come into the experience of being, you know, and understand that what you're experiencing is the divine dimension, and then notice what happens. It's all about noticing and experiencing. And then what happens is oh my gosh, I feel so amazing, and I feel so much love and joy. I feel like I want to like dance on tabletops. I mean, there's a whole new person that comes out when you're in this other dimension. But if you get caught up in why can't I do it? I've been trying so hard, and I'm never good at meditation. That stuff is already taking you out of the moment and trapping you in the mind again.
But everything you're saying makes a lot of sense to me. What about some of the alternative technologies that are out there that claim to move you into this sort of space, ranging from things like ayahuasca, which seems to be enjoying a lot of attention and popularity right now, to brain things that you would put on your head, or
my brother's into those,
or sound.
Yeah,
sounds that are out of sync and so on.
Yeah, brain synchronization.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Well, you know, this dimension of the divine world is here anyway. Okay, and you can do things that explode your brain, like ayahuasca. You know, you can do all sorts of techniques and gimmicks. You know, and if they work fine. But I think in many ways it's made too complicated. I mean, if we stop right now and stop thinking and experience our body as if we've never experienced it so intensely before, and talk slower and come to our senses and feel our being, it's already happening. I mean, I can go there, and of course I would soon stop talking, because the joy would be immense, and it creates a natural kind of sacred activism where, however you are in the world now, it's like sacred being naturally produces sacred doing, and no longer caught up in the mind's polarizing, you know, you versus me kind of mentality. We begin to find out that we're all the same thing. The mystics have been telling us that the only God exists, and the rest of the 10,000 things is the left brain, you know, dividing it up in this analytic process. So when we stop thinking and come to our senses, we begin to experience it again. The goal, therefore, is to follow that experience, go deeper and deeper into it, and notice what changes.
Yeah. You know, I think I have experienced something similar in the past, not so much right now. It was at the birth of my twins, and I was experiencing a lot of joy around that, after going through a tremendous amount of resistance to the idea, and then realizing that, hey, this is happening. There's no way to resist this. It's going to happen. And then somehow I did a 180, and I would lay in bed at night, and I would feel that joy in my heart, and I would conceive of it as like having a volume control. And I would imagine myself turning up the volume control, and I would feel fuller and fuller and more joyful until I kind of fall back, like climbing up to the ice mountain or something.
Yeah. David, that's it. That was exactly that. That's beautiful. We can talk about mysticism as being, you know, a direct experience of the divine, and it comes in three flavors. There's little mystical experiences, big mystical experiences, and mystical consciousness. What you're talking about there is one of the many countless small mystical experiences we can have, like at the birth of our child, you know, or falling in love and seeing the infinite light and beauty of the one you love, or standing in a great cathedral in Europe and realizing it took 7 or 8 generations to build this and being astounded. You can't think because it's so awesome. These are all openings into a mystical experience. And if you, and for you, feeling it in your body, then of course you have the bliss of being that bubbles up. And that was a great technique, that little dial you developed. I think it's
turn
it up.
I need to remember to turn it up. And it's something I've every now and then tried to share with someone else, although I don't know if it's worked for other people. Now, one of the things you talk about is that this divine consciousness begins to move you towards what you call sacred activism. And somehow I guess I need to also, I feel like I'm taking us to these terribly bifurcated states of mind that are the opposite of what you're talking about and where we all need to go. So before, as part of maybe that sacred activism, I mean, one of the things that feels like it's such a barrier is the state of the world. You know, when we look at all the suffering and evil in the world, and the newspaper, the headlines, I can barely bear to pick up a newspaper these days. How do we put these two things together, you know, that seem so irreconcilable?
Yeah. No, you're describing a very common and familiar experience for people. It's paralyzing. It's frankly paralyzing to see what's going on out there. And I think, you know, I recently did a workshop on discernment in terms of how do we respond to the world's problems. And there was this wonderful quote from theologian Howard Thurman that I came across. And this is what he said. He said, "Don't ask what the world needs. Ask yourself what makes you come alive and go do that. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive."
Wow.
So isn't that beautiful? I mean,
yeah, it is. That is.
There's a million problems, but in this kind of sacred consciousness, you know, you are spreading this divine consciousness right where you are, by the way you are, by who you are. So whether it's, you know, an interaction with a clerk in the grocery store, or picking up your kids from school, or writing as I write, or everything you do can become part of a sacred process in which you are changing the world right where you are.
So when you're writing, tell us about that experience that you have when you're writing.
Gosh, you know, I mean, I've been sort of overwhelmed by writing at times. You know, I've just sat down and written 6-7 hours, you know, and not even realized I was hungry, because I just had to get this stuff out and I had to write about it. Then that's the easy part. You know, it's like, you know, pulling the plug and having this gushing stuff come out of me. The hard part then is to say, how do I make this intelligible? The editing is endless.
Yeah.
No one's going to understand that. You got to explain that more.
Yeah.
Because I've worked with so many editors. I've learned a lot about writing.
I'll bet. Because what's the count?
Nine.
Nine, yeah, that's really quite an accomplishment, I think. And the interesting thing to me is that it's not a distraction from what you're talking about, but rather a way of channeling it, enlarging it, opening up to it.
Yeah, Parker Palmer, who's a wonderful Quaker writer, basically defines vocation as, he says, is doing something I cannot not do for reasons I really can't explain to anyone, but are so compelling I have to do them.
Yeah.
That's the nature of the true self. So when we can strip off this old skin of our middle years and let a new blossom of the self come out, you'll discover that there are things that you just cannot not do. And usually, so often, we trivialize them and say, well, you know, that's not a big deal. Anybody could do that. But your friends will say, yeah, no, you do it better than anybody I've ever seen. And so we got to find out where that magic is in ourselves, where that thing is that we cannot not do, because that is the gift we came into the world to share with the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that's part of sacred activism, is sharing who you really are to the world around you.
Yeah. Sometimes I get down on myself about not doing more out there, but then I come back to this thing that I do in interviewing people like you is my gift to the world.
Yes.
And it is an expression of who I am.
If everyone would do just this much, how different a world it would be.
More and more of us are doing it.
Well, that's right.
Yesterday was International Podcaster Day. Nobody knows that except a few of us podcasters.
So the new aging is all about this. You know, it's all about this becoming the third act. You know, the new way of living.
Yeah. So say a little bit more about sacred activism, that this consciousness leads to not sitting and contemplating your belly button, but somehow a moving out, a reaching out, a doing something.
Yeah. I think that it really takes two major forms. One form is where you live out who you really are, and you get drawn to a cause that speaks to you. You got to find the cause that speaks to you. A wonderful gerontologist named Bob Ashley says that you should consider, imagine that you have a tuning fork And that if you're doing the thing that's really right for your soul, that fork will hum. And you'll say, whoa, yeah. And if you're not in the right place, it won't hum. And then you really need to get out of that place. So that we need to find out where we come alive. And then we give, then we bring that aliveness into the world and we make a difference. The other, so the sacred being becomes sacred doing. The other main way is what David Nicole now is writing about in terms of a subtle activism, which is that it's based in many ways on the Maharishi effect, that if you get enough people meditating together in one place, they create a group field. And the science around this is actually becoming more and more compelling, that if you do this in a city with a lot of violence and you do it consistently day after day, the violence levels drop statistically. And when you stop doing it, they come back up again. And so there's this subtle activism movement now forming where people of like-minded souls get together, and you can do this virtually or you could do this in person, and you create a group psychic energy field and put into it whatever you are wanting to focus on or work on, love, forgiveness, healing, you know, and so forth. And you can bring that to places in the world like Syria or you know, like Yemen or wherever, and make a difference there from a distance. And so there's more and more research saying that this is another way that we can have an impact. But this is like all those giant meditative movements, you know, world peace, that's all meditated, yeah, you know, for world peace. Right. Turns out there's something to that. Mm-hmm. And that's another form of sacred activism that's okay, really worth pursuing.
Okay. This is a little step aside, but I wonder if you've found more synchronicities, more awareness of synchronicity, that Jungian concept,
yeah,
as you are in this state of consciousness that you talk about, this mystical state.
You know, it's almost all synchronicity in a way. Yeah. Everything, I mean, everything happening is like, oh my God. I walk down the road sometimes and I stop and I feel like, you know, like this tree or that weed just is calling me, you know, and it's basically saying, stop, stand still. If you will stand still enough, you'll become one with the divine nature of all existence, and you'll disappear and you'll be the same as the tree and the bush and the bird and the plant. And that consciousness changes your molecular structure. And when you come out of it, you're a different kind of person. And that's this movement towards the divine human.
Okay. Sounds good. Sign me up.
You're on. You're already doing it.
Now, you made reference to when we were trying to coordinate our calendars and figuring out when and how we could talk, you mentioned that you would be attending and presenting at something called the Saging International Conference. So I didn't know about that, so I went online and I looked it up, and it looks very intriguing. It's in October 20th to the 23rd. Tell us about this organization, because it seems to be a manifestation of the kind of thing you're talking about.
Yeah, no. In the last probably year and a half, I've taught or presented at like 6 or 7 different aging conferences. There's really this Conscious Elders Networks, Aging International, Creation Spirituality Communities. There are many different. There was a 6th international conference on aging and spirituality I spoke at, and so this is the movement of people like us who do not want to just sit on our rocking chairs and experiencing aging in the grim old decline fashion that was prevalent in the past. So this is, each of these groups has a slightly different orientation. The Conscious Elders Network is very much into activism. Saging International is very much into personal growth. And so you go to this conference and, you know, you have all these really wonderful workshops on how to leave a legacy and how to tell your story, how to find your voice, how to prepare for dying. I mean, everything that you would think would be important in the aging process, there's a workshop on.
Yeah.
And all of it is making you more conscious.
Yeah, I thought it looked very intriguing. It's in this month. Today is October 1st. And I don't think I can get it together in time to do that for this year. So it sounds like you think we're in a time of collective spiritual evolution, that more and more of us are getting on board somehow. Do I have that right?
Yeah. Think about this. So 10,000 people are turning 65 every day, and this will go on for the next 20 years, you know, and by 2030, we'll be over a third of the human population. If even 5% of us could do this kind of work, I believe we would reach a tipping point where we would be in this subliminal consciousness fashion, spreading a new kind of awareness through the world that might soften things. It's very interesting when you look at aging. Aging men, as I said, and what aging men want, are no longer really that interested in going out there and beating up the world and being famous and climbing mountains and competing. What they're much more in the feminine mode. The testosterone levels have fallen. They want to just hold their grandchildren or be in men's groups or share their lives. It's a whole different thing that they want to do. And this is a general thing that's happening to men in this time. Odysseus took 10 years to come home because he had to learn how to give up his warrior nature, which is very difficult for us. But as we do it, we create a new kind of psyche and a new kind of consciousness that I think will change mm-hmm. the world. I believe we are changing.
Speaking of men's group, as we were trying to get our calendars in sync, that was another thing you said, well, I've got to meet with my men's group then.
Yeah.
So I'm still in a men's group. You're still in a men's group.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit about your men's group.
Men's groups are just so wonderful. You know, I think people early on are afraid that if you get into a men's group, you're going to be with guys who are going to, you know, bully you or fight you. It's just not the case. In a men's groups, guys are so grateful to be with other men and to share their lives in a meaningful way. It's like they begin this. They won't miss men's group for anything if it's a good functioning group. And an aging men's group is also wonderful because, I mean, in my previous men's group when I was in Sacramento, I was the oldest guy, and I love these guys, but I was always the pioneer out there ahead. And in this group, I'm like the third oldest, you know, and so I have some older friends that, you know, that are like, you know, 75 and 76. And so we share this evolution of consciousness in ways that we can name and laugh at and talk about, and none of us would quit it for anything. Mm-hmm. It's just a very rich validation of something. You're not weak because you don't want to compete. It's because you are a different kind of person. You want to live in a state of love, not in a state of performance. It's the movement from doing to being, which is so important in aging.
Yeah. Do you have a structure or is it, do you just sort of hang out and share?
We just hang out and we start the check in, and whoever starts, we just go around the group from him.
That's pretty much what we do.
Yeah. It's not complicated. Well, you know, there's no politics, you know, and no intellectual debating of things, no religion. We really just want to be real about who we are.
Uh-huh. So do you kind of rule that out? Let's not talk about politics.
Because sometimes
I'm in a couple of groups, and it can really devolve into a lot of politics stuff.
It will never work.
Yeah. I've never really enjoyed that kind of discussion.
Me neither.
In my whole life.
I've always had a severe distrust of too much talk, you know, because it just kills the awareness.
Yeah, that's something we have in common is a commitment to the experiential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That was always important to me in my teaching as a professor. I felt some obligation to the profession and to the academy to be sure to get some content in there.
Sooner or later.
Yeah, but also wanted to, as much as possible, try to come up with experiential sorts of activities and so on to bring it more into the moment and to make it more internalized.
Yes, and that's the spiritual journey. One day we have to leave all our belief systems. I mean, they're useful up to a point, but they're pointing to a consciousness that's beyond believing. So we have to let go of thought and move into that other state. Okay. And then, see, the right hemisphere is really the hemisphere of the soul, and it's a separate entity. And as we stop talking, thinking, doing, and sit in the stillness of our inner space, this other entity begins to come alive, and we are we are living from a soul consciousness, which is much different from this intellectual identity consciousness that the ego creates.
Okay. Well, I'm feeling very inspired. Is there anything more that you'd like to say?
No, I mean, I've wrestled with how to share this in a way that doesn't sound crazy, you know, and I know it's not, I know it's profoundly real, and I try to share this sometimes with people, and you're either someone interested in it or you're not, apparently, because if you're not interested, people go glassy-eyed, but if you are, then people come alive, and I'm looking for people who have come alive to read my book.
Okay, wonderful, wonderful. And so there is, I just want to let people know that there is a ad in the right-hand sidebar that will take you to John C. Robinson's book corner, so to speak, where you can find his books for sale. And I encourage everybody to go there.
Come visit me at my website, which is www.johnrobinson.org.
Okay, that sounds good. Well, John C. Robinson, Dr. John C. Robinson, it's so great to have you on Shrink Wrap Radio again.
It's my pleasure. This has been a lot of fun. Thanks, David.
I really appreciated this conversation with Dr. John C. Robinson. I felt very energized by him and his enthusiasm. His positivity was positively contagious. I hope you could feel it too. We live in such challenging times that I think this kind of inspiration and spiritual upliftment is particularly important. This was the first time we'd ever actually laid eyes on each other using video. I think the fact that we were on video added an additional dimension that maybe comes through on the audio as well. One thing we didn't emphasize is that you don't have to be old to tap into the dimension John was talking about. But in later years, there may be a bit more space to do so. I don't like to feel preached at, and fortunately, I didn't feel that way at all in this interaction with John. Rather, it was a sharing of his own exuberance that left me plenty of room for my own experience. If you felt energized by this conversation, then you might enjoy John's books, including the latest one, The Divine Human, The Final Transformation of Sacred Aging. You can find an ad he's taken out in the right-hand sidebar. You can find an ad he's taken out in the right-hand sidebar on shrinkwrapradio.com that will take you to his own book site.
I support Shrink Wrap Radio, for Dr. Dave has his pulse on the emerging contemporary rising stars, endeavoring to provide soul food for listeners seeking nourishment. As a recent contributor, I am listening deeply to the contributions you bring us all.
Thank you, Linda. I really appreciate your support and encouraging others to keep Shrink Wrap Radio alive and well. And for my part, I'll do my best to keep that nourishment you refer to coming. If you're not already a financial supporter, I hope you'll join Linda as a donor. I'm happy to welcome one new donor. The donor I'm referring to is Anna Bermudez. Thank you, Anna. Once again, I'd like to thank SwellBee.com for sponsoring this episode. SwellBee.com is a new online marketplace for health and wellness providers. There are other sites on the web, such as Psychology Today, where psychologists and marriage family therapists and such can list their services. The distinctive thing about SwellBee.com is the broad range of practitioners that can list there. For example, they're open to listings by acupuncturists, art therapists, audiologists, chiropractors, doulas, lactation consultants, life coaches, massage therapists, mental health therapists, midwives, nutritionists, dietitians, occupational therapists, physical therapists, respiratory therapists, speech therapists, And I'm sure we could add to that list, for example, yoga therapists, naturopaths, and many more that I'm not thinking of right now. So if you're a mental health therapist or healthcare or alternative practitioner, SwellBe was created with your practice in mind. You know, over 70% of patients and clients start their provider search online. Today, it's crucial for a healthcare practice to have a strong digital footprint, positive patient ratings, and tools to help automate manual tasks. So SwellBe built a marketing platform to accelerate new patient acquisition, increase patient engagement, and drastically reduce the burden on internal resources. Their goal is simple: help providers save time, increase revenue, and improve the overall patient experience. Patients can quickly find your profile online after you join SwellBe's marketplace of verified health and wellness professions. Again, for a limited time, they are offering this service for free. So please head to their website now and sign up at www.swellbe.com. And SwellBe is spelled S-W-E-L-L-B-Y. I want to give you a heads up again that I may miss one or two of my regular podcasts because I'll be traveling to Kingston, New York for the marriage of my son, Matthew. This is a really big deal for my whole family, and I've decided not to be quite so compulsive about Shrink Wrap Radio to get it out on the road amidst all the festivities. I'm sure you'll understand.
Hi, this is United Kingdom-based therapist Catherine Nibbs, author of the Kindle book Cybertrauma, The Darker Side of the Internet for Children and Young People, and I'm on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thank you, Catherine Nibbs, author of Cybertrauma, who will be my next guest. More about that in a bit. Now, let's go to a couple of recent emails from a member of our listener community who has some exciting news to share. Azriel writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. I love your podcast, and I was really hoping to find some way to download your Wise Counsel podcasts. They were not downloadable from iTunes, and you yourself write on your site that they are no longer available. Well, I found all of them at this link." And I'll tell you about the link in a little bit here. He goes on to say, "I took the time to download each one separately in case they stop making them available. So I now have them all. I just thought I would let you know. All the best." And that's from Azriel. Well, I got right back to Azriel to ask him how he found those Wise Counsel podcasts. And he replied, "Every now and then I would Google it, hoping that they were there somewhere. I must admit that although I love your podcasts, I am much more into the guests who are more conventional." He writes in parentheses, "The Jungian ones do not speak to me as much." Close parentheses. "You've mentioned a few times that the Wise Counsel podcast is more conventional. When I finally found it, I was amazed by the topics that you covered. It covers all the topics that I'm interested in. I really appreciate your podcast, and I love the way that you let each guest give over their message. Over time, I've been warming up to the Jungian concepts, but I'm not a convert yet. Keep on trying." Okay, well, I love that. And I'm referring to Azriel as male, but I don't know if I'm pronouncing the name correctly. And in fact, I don't know the gender, so I hope I haven't given any offense. Well, I am so thrilled that Azriel has been able to find a link to the entire Wise Counsel collection. And I'm not sure how long it will be there either. So I would suggest that if you're at all interested in hearing those, if I do say so myself, wonderful collection of interviews, you should get right on it. So I have put a link on the website, shrinkwrapradio.com, under the tab About Dr. Dave. And if you read down, you'll find several paragraphs down, you'll see a section where I'm talking about Wise Counsel, and it will say, click here, and here will be highlighted. So that is the doorway. So all of you who've been asking me for a way to get wise counsel, this is the answer. And I am so grateful to Azriel for finding it. So with that, I think we better wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. And you can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014, or you can use our app for that. Thanks to today's guest, Dr. John C. Robinson, for sharing his inspirational message. On my next interview, I will be speaking with child and adult trauma therapist, Catherine Nibbs. She is author of the 2016 Kindle book, Cyber Trauma, The Darker Side of the Internet for Children and Young People, and we'll be discussing her work. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.